If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
It's 8 o'clock.
Good morning. President Trump is hitting the road to sell his efforts to lower prices, even though he calls the affordability issue a hoax. Can he convince voters before the midterm elections? It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
On KQED News, talks resume between striking teachers and the West Contra Costa School District. I'm Brian White.
Indiana Republicans are answering Trump's call to try and get rid of the state's Democrats in Congress. I'm Layla Faldin.
And Amy Martinez. Trump pressured the state Senate to call a vote on new district maps. Some Republican holdouts have been threatened. Also, Maria Corina Machado, the latest Nobel Peace Prize winner, seems to have given up on peaceful regime change in Venezuela. And is West Texas ready for a black bear resurgence? Since Tuesday, December 9th, on this day in 1965, a Charlie Brown Christmas aired for the first time on CBS. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump says he's going to let the U.S.-based chipmaker NVIDIA sell one of its most advanced microchips to China. The chips are used in artificial intelligence. NPR's John Ruich reports the policy shift comes amid worries about U.S. leadership in the AI sector.
Trump says on social media the U.S. will allow NVIDIA to sell H200s to approved customers in China, quote, under conditions that allow for continued strong national security. He says he told Chinese leader Xi Jinping about it, and she responded positively. Trump also indicates that the U.S. would get a cut of sales. The H200 is what's known as a GPU chip. It hit the market last year, and it's better than its predecessor, the H100 model, which has been a workhorse of AI data centers. NVIDIA's best chips, the Blackwell series, are not part of this deal. The U.S. has imposed a virtual embargo on cutting-edge chips and chip-making equipment going to China out of fear that the U.S. could lose its lead in the AI race. John Ruich, NPR News.
An environmental group wants a national moratorium on the construction of some new data centers that power artificial intelligence. More than 230 groups have signed on to a letter to Congress. NPR's Jeff Brady reports.
The group Food and Water Watch drafted the letter, citing the risk of higher utility bills and environmental concerns. Mitch Jones with Food and Water Watch says a pause is needed so regulation can catch up.
And let's figure out if it's possible to do this in a way that is going to be safe for the environment, that is going to preserve water for communities, that is not going to drive up people's already increasing electricity prices.
The industry group Data Center Coalition said in a statement that halting construction would jeopardize digital infrastructure that's essential to contemporary life. The coalition argues a moratorium would risk U.S. economic competitiveness and national security. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
The Department of Housing and Urban Development is revising controversial changes to funding that is intended to reduce homelessness. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports the HUD move comes in the wake of two lawsuits.
States, cities, and nonprofits warned that HUD's overhaul could push 170,000 people back into homelessness. In a surprise move, the agency told the court it will withdraw its changes for now to address such concerns. But a government lawyer said HUD still intends to shift toward more transitional housing and mandated treatment. The agency has also set new conditions for who can get money based on alignment with Trump administration policies, such as DEI and restricting transgender rights. The two lawsuits allege all those changes are unconstitutional. They say Congress has made clear homelessness funding should be based on need and spent on programs with proven success. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up more than 100 points. You're listening to NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. Good morning. Closing arguments are expected to wrap up today in the murder trial of San Francisco filmmaker Kevin Epps. KQED's Sarah Hosseini reports.
On Monday, Epps' defense team tried to chip away at prosecutors' portrayal of Marcus Polk, Epps' ex-brother-in-law, as an affable, if troubled family member who routinely visited to hang out, watch TV, and even help out. Prosecutors told jurors that Epps shot Polk out of irritation during one of these visits at the home of Epps' then-fiancé and their children. But Epps' lawyers argued that Polk was an unwelcome intruder with a meth habit who refused to leave when Epps asked him to. They said Polk threatened to beat up maintenance workers outside and later came at Epps, who shot him in self-defense. I'm Sarah Hosseini, KQED News.
The Trump administration yesterday denied Endangered Species Act protection to Western Coast Chinook salmon in Northern California. Administration officials wrote that based on the best available scientific evidence, after a review, the species does not require additional protection. Environmental groups say the spring run Chinook salmon are in significant decline. Jeff Miller is with the Center for Biological Diversity.
I mean, this isn't going to just harm these salmon. It's going to harm all the other wildlife that depends on them. Orcas almost preferentially feed on these spring run Chinook.
Miller says the group is seeking ways to appeal the federal decision and ways California itself can protect the fish. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support comes from San Francisco Bay University, providing education to prepare students for an AI-driven economy, sfbu.edu. Support for NPR comes from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And the listeners of KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highlands Sacramento. 806, over to Clark Reed for a San Francisco traffic update.
A stall is reported southbound 101 at Candlestick Point. It's over the shoulder with a tow on the scene, but things are stop and go from the 80-101 split now. Conked out vehicle in Oakland, westbound 580, 480 in the maze. That's in the number 2 lane. Things there jammed from 980 and 24. And in Novato, still a long slog. South 101 after 37, an accident there. It's a crawl from Roland now and continues heavy down to the Marin Civic Center. Clark Reed for KQED.
Traffic support for Clark comes to us from Glime the Jeweler. I'm Dave Freeman. Good morning. KQED News ahead with Brian Watt. Coming up at 8:22, one of the medical treatments gaining traction here in the Bay Area involves ketamine. Doctors are prescribing it to treat a lot of things, including mental health. But treatment can vary, and the science is still early. What does that mean for patients? More on KQED News coming right up at 8:22. More fog, some sun mixed together around the Bay Area, sort of a repeat of yesterday, depending on where you're at across the Bay. Cooler temperatures again today, highs in the 50s to the 60s. The Weather Service says slowly warming up through Friday. Beach hazard statement begins tomorrow morning through Friday. Watch out for high surf and sneaker waves along the coast. Sacramento, another day of areas of fog and haze forecast later in the afternoon and cloudy skies today. It's 8:07.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And Amy Martinez in Culver City, California. President Trump travels to Mount Pocono, Pennsylvania today to talk about his administration's efforts to address a top concern for voters, affordability.
At the White House on Monday, he gave a preview.
You can call it affordability or anything you want, but the Democrats caused the affordability problem. And we're the ones that are fixing it. So it's a very simple statement. They caused it. We're fixing it.
This claim after he previously called affordability a, quote, hoax. In a few moments, we'll unpack the administration's messaging with the Republican strategist. First, let's take a look at Trump's trip, as recent polls show voters blame the president's policies for high prices.
NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith joins us now. Tam, this sort of travel, going out and selling your policies, that's what presidents typically do, except not this year so far.
Yeah, in his second term, President Trump has done very little domestic travel aimed at pitching his policies to the American people. In fact, he's done way more travel to sporting events than going out in the country and making his case. A senior White House official I spoke with, who was not authorized to speak publicly, readily acknowledged that this sort of messaging travel has been lacking and said the president would be ramping it up late this year and into next year, starting with today's trip to Pennsylvania, which is to a competitive congressional district.
I'd rather go to sporting events, too, but that's just me. So what's this first stop message going to be?
Well, the senior White House official I spoke to said that the president will be balancing talking about what they see as real economic good news with an acknowledgement that there's more work to do. And just ask President Biden about the perils of telling people that, well, actually, the economy is fine when their cost of living is way up. Getting the tone right on the economy is something presidents have often struggled with. Trump himself has been a bit off message. Take this from a cabinet meeting last week.
The word affordability is a con job by the Democrats. They say affordable. I watched the other day where some very low IQ congresswoman talked about affordability. She had no idea. Their prices were much higher.
And inflation did get alarmingly high under Biden, but then it slowed down. The most recent inflation numbers show that the rate in September was the same as it was during Biden's last month in office.
Okay, then will Trump's messaging be paired with any new policies that could actually bring prices down?
It's a good question, and I'd say that you can never be certain what Trump will say until he says it. But in recent weeks, we've seen a lot of officials all the way up to the vice president asking for patience, saying it will take time for the president's policies to hit the economy. White House economist Kevin Hassett was on CNBC yesterday and said people with income from tips and overtime should get tax refunds next year.
That kind of stuff is going to make it so that people are going to look at their wallets and say, oh, boy, this guy's really making me better off. And in the end, that's more important than any poll.
But the polls are a problem. Trying to turn that around before the midterms is part of what Trump's doing out on the road today. And yesterday, the president announced a $12 billion bailout for farmers who've been hurt by his tariffs. The administration is casting this as bridge money until the president's trade deals pay off. But it's also an acknowledgement that there are real economic pain points.
All right, that's NPR's Tamara Keith. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Donald Trump made rising costs a central theme of his 2024 presidential campaign. Here he is during a campaign rally last year.
Under Kamala Harris and crooked Joe Biden, the American dream is dead. You don't hear about the American dream anymore. It's dead. Her radical liberal policies have caused horrific inflation, decimated the middle class, and gutted the finances of millions and millions of American families.
But 11 months into Trump's second term, consumer prices are rising, and he's trying to distance himself from the problem.
Just about everything is down. You know, this whole thing is, they use the word affordability. It's a Democrat hoax. They're the ones that drove the prices up.
How's that message playing with voters, and could it be a problem for Republicans in the midterms? Let's talk about it with Republican strategist Brendan Buck. He's a partner in the consulting firm Seven Letter and previously worked as a staffer for two former House speakers, Paul Ryan and John Boehner. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so the president campaigned on affordability. Then from the White House, he's calling it a Democratic hoax, but at the same time blaming higher prices on Democrats. How is that going to play with voters?
Yeah, messaging on the economy is always hard because you're confronting people's experiences every day and trying to, especially when you're trying to tell them something that is different than what they feel. So it takes a lot of work and it takes a lot of discipline. I think the challenge for this White House is that this is a president who seems very not bought into this idea that it is even a problem. And they can send him to Pennsylvania and they can put the right talking points in the teleprompter. But if he doesn't actually believe it, I think it's going to be hard for them to continue to make a difference on people, how people feel about it. All it takes is one or two more lines like that, that this is a hoax or a con job, and Democrats are going to be able to take this issue away from him. And as you said, it's the issue that he won the election on.
So you mentioned Pennsylvania. He's expected to talk about high costs at a rally later today. What should he tell Americans? I mean, you're saying he doesn't even believe there is an affordability issue.
Well, one of the things that Donald Trump was always very good at, and polls showed this, is that he was better than most Republicans at empathy. Mm. People felt like he was actually fighting for them. And that was an issue where polls showed that Donald Trump cared more about people than the Democratic Party. And that's something that Republicans had always struggled with. And that was an advantage that he took. And now I think he's squandering that away. It certainly doesn't feel empathetic when he's telling people that that their issue is a con job. At the same time, people don't see him focusing on this issue every day. You know, they're talking about a few of these economic issues now, but most of this administration has been spent focusing on foreign policy issues, or even some trivial issues. I mean, people look up and see him working on the a ballroom or hosting Kennedy Center honors, and that doesn't project a message that you are laser focused on the thing that they care about. So they need to talk about it. They need to put policies in place. I would start with the tariffs. Getting rid of those would be, I think, a huge start. But I'm not holding my breath that he's going to give up on what he considers one of his signature policy achievements.
Is this president making the same mistake as President Biden, trying to convince Americans that affordability, that what they're feeling is not really what they're feeling? The economy is good. Affordability isn't an issue.
Clearly, and we've seen what happens with votes when you do that. Voters will take it out on the party in power. I mean, I think every party suffers from this a little bit, where you get elected and you think that you were elected based on everybody loving all of your ideas, when in reality it was really more likely just a rejection of the previous administration and what they did. Voters will take it out on you if you do not make their lives feel better. And right now, it's very clear that the president has squandered his polling on the economy. And it would be one thing if there really was a bright light at the end of the tunnel here, if there was something coming next year that we could reliably think is going to make people feel better. I'm just not convinced that the one big beautiful bill, the tax act they did this past year, is actually going to change people's feelings going into next year. So, yeah, it's a huge problem.
So is this a lane that the Democrats now own politically, messaging-wise, with voters because they're not in power? We saw that work really well in elections this year for Democrats, like New York City Mayor-elect Zohran Mamdani's race.
Yeah, and it's as simple as you said, just not being in power. I mean, sometimes we overthink these things, that Democrats need a 10-point plan of how they're going to lower inflation. I think that is good to have if they have it, but as a matter of pure politics, simply being the out party and the party out of power and saying that the people in charge aren't getting it done is really powerful. That's what happened with Joe Biden. He was in charge. It was on his watch. Didn't solve the problem. And Donald Trump will probably meet the same fate in the midterms if he faces the same situation. You've been in charge for a year or 2 years by the time the midterm terms comes around, and you haven't solved the problem. It's as simple as that. And people will swing to the other party unless they feel like you are addressing their core concerns.
Brendan Buck is a Republican strategist with the firm Seven Letter. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
After weeks of speculation, Representative Jasmine Crockett officially launched her U.S. Senate campaign in Dallas yesterday. Crockett has garnered national attention for her outspoken criticism of President Trump, and now she's aiming to do something no Texas Democrat has done since 1994, and that's win a statewide election. Becca Moore from member station KERA in Dallas reports.
As Jasmine Crockett told supporters at her campaign announcement in South Dallas Monday night, her gloves have been off, but now she's jumping into the ring.
Because Texas, this moment we're in now, is life or death. It's all or nothing. It's now or never.
Texas Democrats know that unseating the incumbent Republican John Cornyn won't be easy, but think their best chance is with a more polarizing candidate, like Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. He's running against Cornyn in the GOP primary. Paxton is a Trump loyalist with a controversial background. Democratic organizers hope that makes him vulnerable given recent trends and a candidate Crockett could beat. In last month's election, voters showed strong support for Democratic candidates in typically Republican strongholds, and Crockett's hoping to capitalize on that shift.
My message, rooted in slashing costs, making homeownership and entrepreneurship attainable for all, strengthening and growing the middle class, is one that Texas, all of Texas, from the Panhandle to Port Arthur and from El Paso to East Texas, can believe in.
And polling shows Crockett may have the best chance of all the Democratic hopefuls. In a recent survey from the University of Houston's Hobby School of Public Affairs, she received the majority support of likely voters in a hypothetical contest against Texas State Representative James Tallarico and former Congressman Colin Allred. She'll only face Tallarico in the primaries, though. Allred dropped out to avoid a runoff and to maximize the chance of Democrats flipping the seat. But doing so in a reliably red state will be an uphill battle. Crockett urged her supporters not to let that deter them.
For most of us, a Republican-controlled Texas is all we've known. But we cannot let that diminish our faith and belief in what can be.
If Crockett is successful in her Senate bid, she'll be the first Black woman to ever win a statewide election in Texas. For NPR News, I'm Becca Moore in Dallas.
This is NPR News.
KQED at 8:19, covering Northern California and the latest KQED news ahead with Brian Watt at 8:22. Clark Reed checking in again. Let's go find out about your drive around San Jose now.
An accident reported on northbound 101 at Brokaw. It's over the shoulder, but things are stop and go there from Hellier. Oakland, we still have a stall. West 580 before 80 in the maze. It's in the number 2 lane. Things are jammed up there from 980 and 24. And there's a stall in Orinda now, too. Westbound 24 before Wilder. It's off to the center divide, but that has things slow from St. Stephens. Clark Reed for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from Post Peninsula Open Space Trust. Post has protected and cared for more than 93,000 acres of open space on the peninsula and in the South Bay for the benefit of all. Learn more at openspacetrust.org. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping public radio advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The Knight Foundation believes informed and engaged communities are essential for healthy democracy. More at kf.org.
If you're planning a trip to a national park next year, get ready for some big changes. The Trump administration is dropping free entry on civil rights holidays like MLK Day and Juneteenth, and adding President Trump's birthday instead. Plus, international visitors will face higher fees and new ID checks. I'm Abby Bolaños. We'll walk you through what's changing and why it matters on the next California Report.
30 minutes away.
I'm Alexis Madrigal. Next time on Forum, in California, mobile homes make up between 4 and 6% of the housing stock, and they play a critical role in creating affordable housing. New state laws and efforts by for-profit developers to buy up mobile home communities are putting this kind of housing at risk. We're going to talk to experts about the challenges that mobile homeowners face. That's at 9 a.m. right here on KQED.
Support for NPR comes from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm, Arm.com. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, for nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at Mott.org. And Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor, can help build a flexible wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And the listeners and members of KQED. The time approaching 8:22.
It's Morning Edition on KQED. I'm Brian Watt. A major BART expansion is underway in Santa Clara County, where crews are preparing to dig a massive tunnel underneath San Jose. KQED's Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman went to the construction site yesterday and has this report.
Just blocks away from San Jose Mineta International Airport is a site the VTA is calling the West Portal.
Follow those folks for me, please. I appreciate it. Watch your footing.
This dirt lot is about a mile long, and it's full of cranes, trucks, and crews. All the work right now is focused on preparing a steep concrete ramp for the arrival of a tunnel boring machine. Sarah Wilson is the construction director for BART Silicon Valley Phase 2.
It's really cool. It's huge. It's state-of-the-art. Like, it's going to be so much fun.
The project will add 6 new miles of BART track, 4 new stations, and connect with the existing BART system at Berryessa Station. Most of that track will be located under San Jose.
We can see progress, and we have momentum, and we need to keep that momentum going.
Tom McGuire is with the VTA, which is building the expansion. The project was originally slated to finish by next year at a cost of $4.7 billion. But it's faced heavy delays and cost overruns. It's now expected to cost nearly 3 times that and take more than 10 years longer. Sudhanshu Jain is a Santa Clara City Council member and a member of the BART Oversight Committee for this project.
Oh, it's transformational because, you know, we're already have massive traffic congestion.
When it's completed, the expansion will connect with Caltrain in Santa Clara, creating a ring of electrified rail transit around the San Francisco Bay. I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman, KQED News.
A growing number of people in the Bay Area are turning to ketamine for relief from depression, anxiety, even chronic pain. But treatment can differ wildly from one provider to the next. KQED health correspondent Leslie McClurg has more, and a note, this story contains a mention of sexual abuse.
On a cozy gray couch, Aaliyah Economos settles in across from her therapist. She takes a few deep breaths. Then she lifts a ketamine nasal spray to her nose. Soon, visions begin to flood her mind.
The Black Widow, the devil, Medusa, the fire-breathing dragon, evil itself.
What begins as dissociated images transforms into flashbacks from her childhood that eventually clarify into
a very vivid memory of being sexually abused.
She had forgotten it all until she tried ketamine-assisted therapy.
I did not have the capacity to feel into the depth and the pain of what my body was holding back without it.
Economos is 51. She's very put together. But for most of her life, the mother of three felt flat inside. She cycled through antidepressants. And then about 6 years ago, her mental health collapsed.
My body really just shut down entirely on me. I couldn't get out of bed. And
did something happen?
No, nothing happened.
She couldn't work. She saw doctor after doctor, but every test came back normal. She saw a trauma specialist, tried naturopaths, elimination diets. At one time, she was taking
like 38 pills a day.
Nothing helped until she tried ketamine. Historically, the drug has lived in very different worlds. In hospitals, doctors use it as a safe and reliable anesthetic. In clubs, partiers illegally take it to feel a sense of euphoria. In recent years, psychiatrists have prescribed it for treatment-resistant depression. Basically, it disrupts how brain cells normally talk to each other. Gerard Santacora is a professor of psychiatry at the Yale School of Medicine.
Shortly after getting a dose of ketamine, there's an increase in the brain's ability to form new connections that could be sustained.
Studies show it can snap people out of suicidal spirals.
It really is a potentially life-saving drug for many people.
The FDA approved esketamine in 2019, a chemical cousin of ketamine. Because it's covered by insurance, Jennifer Siegel signed up for 10 sessions at an Oakland clinic. The 57-year-old was in a tough place.
It started with my brother's suicide.
Then her father died.
And I was going through divorce.
By then, her antidepressant had been paired with an antipsychotic to boost its effect, but
they weren't strong enough anymore, which is what led to the ketamine.
She walked into a bare treatment room, just a recliner, box of tissues, a jar of Jolly Ranchers. When the session started, the nasal spray slid down her throat, numbing her mouth and sending her into a wave of panic. The psychiatrist stayed mostly silent, even as Siegel began to cry.
That he was just there to make sure I didn't die, basically, is how I felt.
The experience was so off-putting that she canceled the series. Instead, she paid out of pocket for a clinic with a much warmer approach.
It's exactly what I had been looking for.
When ketamine is prescribed off-label, the dose, the number of infusions, aftercare instructions can all differ, even from clinics within the same city. Smita Das is an addiction psychiatrist at Stanford Medicine.
There's more and more of these clinics that are popping up that are touting ketamine as a treatment for depression, PTSD, OCD, and more, without it actually being currently in practice guidelines.
And is there any research showing that it can work for these things?
Yeah, there's certainly promising studies. However, just because there is a study of, you know, a small handful of people, we still don't know how effective that medication is in the long term.
So why are doctors prescribing it for so many things, and how can they? Think of it like Botox, which the FDA cleared for eye spasms, but doctors have expanded its use for migraines, jaw pain, dozens of other conditions. The same is true for ketamine. It's cleared as an anesthetic, but being used to treat much more. And that can serve patients like Aaliyah Economos. She says she's never felt better.
The body aches are completely gone.
She's off antidepressants, her energy's back, and she credits ketamine. But with treatment that varies from clinic to clinic, and the science still early, patients are left to decide if it's worth the risk. I'm Leslie McClurg, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. You're listening to Morning Edition on KQED.
Now at 8:29, it's Clark Reed with Bay Area Traffic.
Heading back to Oakland with a stall, westbound 580 before 80 in the maze was in the number 2 lane. Looks like they've got it out of the lanes now. The jam is starting to clear from 980 and 24. Also a stall in Orinda. This is west 24 before Wilder. It's at the center divide. Things there are slow from St. Stephen's. Clark Reed for KQED.
Our latest traffic support comes from Glime the Jeweler. Support for KQED comes from Marin Country Mart at Larkspur Landing, an authentic 1970s village with more than 40 independent shops, a dozen eateries, and local services such as a toy store, bookstore, and barber shop. Learn more at marincountrymart.com. Widespread fog, Sacramento Valley. Later today, some sun and haze through late afternoon, some early afternoon patchy fog also hanging around. Highs 44 to 52. Around the bay, some cloud cover and some fog. Sunshine later today. Highs in the 50s to the 60s. The time is 8:30.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Hundreds chanting "Stop the Steal" outside the Indiana State Legislature yesterday in the latest battle over mid-decade redistricting by the GOP. President Trump has urged Republican-led state legislatures in multiple states to redraw lines that could help the GOP gain congressional seats in next year's midterms and keep their majority in the U.S. House. The Indiana bill has advanced and will come up for a vote in the state Senate later this week. One Democrat's looking to leave the U.S. House. Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett says she's running for the Senate.
There are a lot of people that said, you got to stay in the House. We need our voice. We need you there. And I understand. But what we need is for me to have a bigger voice.
A federal judge has ruled that the Justice Department can publicly disclose investigative materials from a sex trafficking case against Ghislaine Maxwell, the former girlfriend of the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. President Trump has faced pressure, including from members of his own base, to release all materials related to Epstein and those who knew the powerful financier, including the president himself. Trump maintains he had no knowledge of Epstein's sex crimes. At last check on Wall Street, the Dow is up 148 points. This is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. Negotiations between striking teachers and the West Contra Costa School District are set to resume today. KQED's Aya Ali Ahmad spoke to teachers and parents yesterday outside district headquarters.
Hundreds of educators, parents, and students rallied in Richmond to urge the district to return to the bargaining table. Erica Cheval is a parent in the district.
Our teachers want to be back with our students. Yes. And the district is the only thing getting in the way. Enough is enough.
Union leaders say the district has been stalling, but officials say they've invited teachers back to the negotiating table. Sasha Hahn is a student at El Cerrito High.
And every day that the district doesn't negotiate with our teachers is another day that us as students are being neglected.
Teachers are asking for substantial raises to address what they call a staffing crisis. I'm Aya Ali Ahmad, KQED News.
Oakland is reinstating a position that oversees public funding for the arts. In June, the city council approved a budget that made several cuts, including doing away with the cultural affairs manager role, prompting protests by artists and activists. Earlier this month, the Oakland side reports, the council voted to reinstate the position. The city's cultural affairs manager helps run a volunteer board that advises Oakland on policy issues affecting artists, and they secure external funding for the arts. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support today comes from Oakland San Francisco Bay Airport. Beauty, pride, love. Learn more at iFlyOAK.com. Support for KQED comes from VisitorsCoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com. Ahead for you, Indiana Republicans are weighing a plan backed by President Trump to redraw its congressional map to add more GOP seats ahead of next year's midterm election. A story there, and California stories are coming right up with Mari Bolaños on your California Report. This week at KQED.org, we meet two Bay Area teenagers who are mapping the movements of coyotes in Silicon Valley, plus how to understand your options for paying back student loans, all at KQED.org. Support for NPR comes from MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more. MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. And Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And by the listeners and sustaining members of KQED, I'm Dave Freeman. Good morning on Tuesday, now 8:35.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Now to Indiana, where the state Senate is convening in a special session this week. Senators plan to vote on new political maps that would help Republicans capture all 9 of Indiana's seats in Congress.
It's the latest in an unprecedented wave of mid-cycle redistricting spurred by President Trump's demands to boost his party's chances in next year's midterms.
NPR congressional reporter Sam Greenglass joins us now from Indianapolis. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Leila.
So lots of states, right, are doing this mid-cycle redistricting in this kind of tit-for-tat. Why is Indiana so notable?
Well, first, it is high drama. We do not know what's going to happen here. Currently, Indiana is represented by 7 Republicans and 2 Democrats. The proposed map would dismantle those 2 heavily Democratic districts. Even many Republican lawmakers have pushed back despite a lot of pressure from Trump and his allies. So if this effort fails, it's a huge rebuke. And if it passes, Democrats could be wiped out from Indiana's delegation.
So a lot at stake here. You're there in Indianapolis. What are you seeing at the state capitol?
Hundreds of protesters with handmade signs packed the hall outside the Senate yesterday. The protesters opposed to redistricting were chanting so loudly that senators could hear it inside the chamber. 127 people signed up for public comment. I met one of them, Leon Bates.
Franklin said, democracy is a wonderful thing if you can keep it. And here we are. We may be watching it slip away right before our eyes.
Bates told me his predominantly black community will be chopped up. The new map will divide Indianapolis into 4, so a voter in the city could soon be in a district that stretches 150 miles to Kentucky.
Wow. So remind us why this redistricting push is happening now.
Normally, new maps are drawn after a census, but Trump has pushed Republican-run states to redraw before the midterms. Voter Gregory Cantor told lawmakers that Republicans have to do what they can to keep the House.
It's the choice between the president your voters elected, 60 to 40, having a full term, or being a lame duck fighting endless nonsense impeachments and investigations.
So now some Democratic-controlled states are trying to redistrict, too.
Now, Republicans control Indiana's legislature, so why is passing this new map not a sure thing?
A lot of Republicans have heard from constituents that they do not want this. The top Senate Republican initially rebuffed holding a session, saying the votes just weren't there. But Trump amped up the pressure, even calling out undecided members by name. Some Republican senators, like Greg Walker, faced threats of violence. Last night, he said relenting in his opposition would have been like accepting a bribe, and said the stakes really crystallized for him recently as he held a constituent's baby.
As I thought about the future for that child, where we accept that intimidation is normal, and I shall refuse the offer for the sake of that child and the future of the state.
You can really hear the emotion in his voice. Does it seem like this new map will become law?
The map already passed the House and advanced out of a Senate committee last night, but the Indiana Senate Majority Leader told us we're all going to find out what will happen when the Senate votes later this week.
NPR congressional reporter Sam Greenglass in Indianapolis. Thank you, Sam.
Thanks, Leila.
Black bears are making a comeback in far west Texas. Now, they used to be the biggest predator there, but overhunting led to their decline. For decades, there were so few black bears that it was illegal to kill them in Texas. But conservation efforts paid off, and now they're getting spotted in rural towns and cities. So are Texans ready to welcome the bears back? Here's Carlos Morales.
In one of the most remote corners of Texas, Matt Hewitt is unlocking the door to a giant steel trap he's hoping will catch a bear.
Yeah, it's completely empty.
Hewitt is with the Borderlands Research Institute in Alpine, Texas.
And I'm trying to look at population abundance, so trying to figure out how many bears are out here.
The 8-foot-long trap is made of steel. On one end, there's a sliding door, and inside is a dangling plastic jug. Hewitt fills it with bait, stale, days-old glazed donuts and frozen cantaloupe.
All right, that'll catch a bear.
The number of black bears in West Texas has been on the rise. Sightings in the state have jumped from nearly 80 in 2020 to just over 130 so far this year. But Hewitt says in West Texas, an exact population count is still unclear.
But I think it's safe to say there's more than people realize. There's quite a few bears out here.
Black bears have a deep history in the area. Landmarks like canyons and creeks have been named after them, and there's even a bear mascot out here. But for all the celebration, there are challenges and concerns as bears have ventured into neighborhoods, gotten into yards, and have posed a threat to livestock, too.
I don't mind the bears coming back. We don't want them wiped out, that's for sure. You know, they were almost extinct.
That's Pam Klaus. She grew up in Alpine and considers herself a wildlife enthusiast.
I just don't think that they belong on our property.
Klaus says her and her husband used to sprinkle food and keep troughs of water on their property for wildlife, like roaming deer and javelina. They've since removed all of that at the suggestion of state officials, and they even electrified their fence. But the bears are still coming around.
These bears are pretty large. They're probably 400 or 500 pounds, if I had to guess.
In places like Montana and Colorado, they've adapted to living with bears by installing bear-resistant dumpsters and trash bins, and in some cases, even installing alarm systems or sprinklers, things to try to startle bears so they leave. But really, the most important measure? Removing food.
They have great sense of smell, much better than our own, so number one, they can smell food when you and I would never have a clue.
That's Raymond Skiles. He's the former wildlife biologist at Big Bend National Park. Skiles says it took time and work at the park, but they were able to adapt to the return of bears there. But can that happen in cities and towns across West Texas?
That's a great question. You know, will people adapt to bears and their environment here in West Texas?
From the mountainous reaches of the national park, an area dotted with prickly pears and yuccas, the bears are now pushing north. Wildlife experts say it's likely because the land there has reached what they call carrying capacity.
And when you're over carrying capacity, there's not the resources on the natural landscape for those animals.
Krista Demery is with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department.
So then they begin to move out and search for new food sources.
Demery's job is making sure people across West Texas are ready to live with bears, something they haven't experienced in decades.
And that's a long time. That means there's not a generation alive really today that has had to live with black bear before.
But the next generation in Alpine, and the ones after that, will likely grow up knowing this place, once again, as bear country. For NPR News, I'm Carlos Morales in Alpine, Texas.
Look for the bear necessities, the simple bear necessities. Forget about your... Work.
This is NPR News.
We'll head over to Mountain View with Clark Reed. He has a look at traffic for you in the South Bay.
It's an accident northbound 85 before El Camino Real. Number 2 lane is blocked there. It's slow from 280. Arenda, we still have a stall. Westbound 24 before Wilder. That's at the center divide. It's slow there from St. Stephen's. And a crash in San Jose. Northbound 101 at Brokaw. It's over the shoulder, but things there are stop and go from Hellier. Clark Reed for KQED.
Thanks again, Clark. Traffic support comes to us from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Good morning. I'm Dave Freeman at 843 with a listener perspective. John Levine talks about his experience with wild turkeys and what makes them interesting birds.
Traffic slowed, then suddenly stopped. I was on my way home from running errands, and though I was not in a huge hurry, I found myself tensing up. I got out of my car to see what the holdup was. A flock of wild turkeys, 5 to be exact, was leisurely crossing the street. But they weren't moving very fast. In fact, they just seemed to be walking to and fro, oblivious to the cars that had stopped to avoid hitting them. I was impressed that my fellow motorists were willing to take a few minutes out of their busy day to allow these birds to find their way across the street. I was reminded of other instances when I found my schedule interrupted by wildlife crossing, waiting for sheep to traverse a rural road in New Zealand, watching a herd of cattle meander across a byway in Nigeria. I was on vacation then, so I wasn't as concerned about getting somewhere. I saw the animals as more of a spectacle and less of an inconvenience. Recently, there have been stories of people intimidated by the proliferation of turkeys. Some birds have been reportedly acting aggressively. There are more than a few stories about birds pecking car doors, supposedly part of a mating ritual, mistaking the reflection for a rival turkey. There's a myth that Benjamin Franklin lobbied for the wild turkey as the American symbol over the bald eagle. He considered the turkey a much more respectable bird than the eagle. Today, due to conservation efforts that began in the 1970s, wild turkeys inhabit 49 of the 50 states, Alaska being the exception. There, bald eagles are abundant, and Alaskans' attitudes towards eagles range from respect to disgust. Just as Californians might see our wild turkeys as pests, so Alaskans look at eagles. As we move into the hustle and bustle of the holiday season, perhaps we can extend our wishes of goodwill beyond people to nature, including turkeys. With a perspective, I'm John Levine.
John Levine is a writer, teacher, and fledgling birder. He lives in Berkeley. Support for Perspectives comes from Leif Cabraser, Hyman & Bernstein, seeking justice for the injured, victims of fraud, whistleblowers, employees, and investors in the Bay Area and nationally for over 5 decades. Online at lchb.com. Up next for you on Morning Edition here on KQED News, the federal HIPAA law protects patient privacy, but some say it can shut out family members trying to help relatives who are experiencing mental health crisis. Those and more stories ahead, along with your California Report, 8:51. And then, if you can, stay with us. Forum begins at 9 with Alexis Madrigal and Mina Kim. Support for NPR comes from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. And by the listeners, members, sustaining members of KQED.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Good morning. A visit to a doctor's office often means patients have to sign a HIPAA form. The Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act limits when medical information can be shared. But some advocates say those protections can also get in the way of care. Maxwell Howard from member station Interlochen Public Radio brings us the story of a mother and son in Michigan.
Lori is 74 and retired. But when her son Stephen was diagnosed with a schizoaffective disorder a few years ago, she became his sole caretaker. We're only using first names here to protect Stephen's medical privacy.
One of the things that he does when he goes really manic or psychotic or whatever it is he starts emptying things. And so he started taking all of the antiques out into the front yard. That was the first time he was hospitalized.
Because Stephen is in his 40s, Lori is often excluded from his emergency care at different hospitals. She's now pursuing temporary medical guardianship so providers can speak with her directly. But for now, she says, HIPAA still makes it difficult to help.
He came out of the hospital once with extreme diarrhea, extreme thirst, and he said his heart hurt, which if you look at some of those medications is a side effect. When I call, they won't talk to me. They won't tell me what he's been on.
Lori says she's repeatedly asked staff at Munson Medical Center in Traverse City to notify her when her son was released, but they often discharged him without notice, including once on a cold winter night in his pajamas and slippers.
He walked home. I hope he didn't have frostbite. I don't know.
Munson declined to comment on individual cases. Dr. Charles DK is a professor of psychiatry at Yale School of Medicine.
It's a very difficult, challenging situation.
He says HIPAA is important especially to these kinds of patients due to stigma around mental health.
It's easier to tell people that, you know, I fractured my humerus, I fractured my thigh, and I was in the hospital for that, it's much more difficult to tell people that I had a mental break. And so the protections that HIPAA has is to allow individuals to take control of what they disclose related to their mental health.
Still, Dr. DK says it's important to keep families informed, especially when patients live at home.
But you're balancing the rights of that individual with the rights of the society to be free of harm.
Critics say it's necessary to change the law. They call the restrictions HIPAA handcuffs. Nearly a decade ago, a congressional effort to eliminate those restrictions fell flat. And since then, recent efforts by grassroots groups petitioning for reform have not been successful. Jerry Clark is an executive at the Treatment Advocacy Center, a Virginia-based nonprofit which advocates for people with severe mental illness. She says the fear of violating HIPAA makes many providers overly cautious because violations can result in fines up to $1.5 million a year, criminal charges, and even jail time. However, she says, that caution can come at patient expense, and there's no reason to exclude caregivers.
I think there's been a lot of misinformation about HIPAA and poor training around HIPAA. So it's easier for providers to say, I can't talk to you.
Clark says that better provider training and a shift away from fear-based HIPAA interpretations could help families stay informed without sacrificing privacy. But until that happens, many caregivers will be left to navigate mental health crises in the dark, trying to keep their loved ones safe without all the information needed. For NPR News, I'm Maxwell Howard in Traverse City.
This is NPR News.
Perhaps you need some traffic information around the Bay this morning. Clark Reed is here with the latest starting in Castro Valley.
An accident eastbound 580 before Redwood. It's in the number 2 lane. Things there are crawling from 238. A crash now in Oakland, northbound 880 before Hagenberger. The left lane is blocked. It's jamming up there from 238. And in San Jose, an accident. North 101 at Brokaw. It's over the shoulder, but has things stop and go from Hellier. Still have a crash in Mountain View, north 85 before El Camino. Slow from 280. Clark Reed for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from Netflix, presenting Left-Handed Girl, Taiwan's official submission for international feature at the Academy Awards. A fresh beginning in Taipei comes with Generations of Secrets, now on Netflix, awards eligible. Stay Healdsburg, home to a holiday collection of festive events and immersive experiences. Learn more at seasontosparkle.com. Cloudy skies, some fog, some sun, depending on where you're at around the Bay Area this morning. More sunshine through the day. Highs again only in the 50s to the 60s inland. Now 8:51.
Good morning. This is the California Report. I'm Abby Bolaños in San Francisco. Workers' comp attorneys say the recent wave of immigration raids is creating a ripple effect, making many workers too afraid to file claims or get treated for injuries on the job. Lisa Hernandez, who sits on the board of the California Applicants Attorneys Association and practices in San Diego, says that before stepped-up immigration enforcement, people would often skip long treatment wait times by crossing into Tijuana for care.
But even now, people don't want to do that either. So people are either A, not reporting the injuries for fear of retribution, B, reporting it but not getting treatment, or C, neither reporting nor getting treatment.
Meanwhile, Moises Vasquez, who sits on the board of Latino Comp, says clients at his Santa Maria office are now scared to travel for medical evaluations.
QMEs that I get are in Bakersfield because that's the closest location. They'll just drop that portion of their case. They won't go to Bakersfield. They won't go to L.A. They won't want to go to even Oxnard for an appointment. They're really afraid.
And they say it's all happening on top of barriers injured workers already struggle with in the state's workers' comp system. California fire safety regulations that were supposed to be implemented by the start of 2026 will be further pushed back, the California Board of Forestry announced yesterday. KQED's Danielle Fenton has more.
The regulation to create an area 5 feet around a home where nothing can easily catch fire was supposed to be completed by the State Board of Forestry by the start of 2023. That never happened. Then, following the LA fires, Governor Newsom directed they be completed by the end of this year. But the Board of Forestry is delaying the matter until March, citing a lack of public buy-in, concerns over the cost of implementation, and the problem of combating misinformation. Some community groups have told homeowners they'll be required to pull out trees. While trees will need to be limbed, removal of mature trees is not part of the proposal. For the California Report, I'm Danielle Vinton.
Support for the California Report comes from Paint Care. Leftover paint can be dropped off and recycled at more than 800 sites in California. PaintCare.org. Stanford Medicine, comprising its School of Medicine and Adult and Children's Health Systems, working together to advance knowledge and improve lives. StanfordMedicine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy works to create a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org.
Californians hoping to take advantage of free entry days at national parks will see big changes next year. The Trump administration is removing civil rights holidays and adding President Trump's birthday instead. The move is already prompting backlash from civil rights groups and conservation advocates. International visitors will also face new rules for park access. So to walk us through what's changing, I'm joined by KQED's outdoors engagement reporter, Sarah Wright. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what exactly is the National Park Service changing about free entry days?
So starting next year, they have revised the calendar of fee-free entry days to national parks, removing Martin Luther King Jr. Day, Juneteenth, other days like the National Public Lands Day, and the anniversary of the Great American Outdoors Act. And in replacement, the National Park Service and Department of Interior have added President Donald Trump's birthday, which is also Flag Day on June 14th. They're also adding the 110th anniversary of the NPS in August, Constitution Day in September, and Teddy Roosevelt's birthday in October, calling those days patriotic fee-free days. In addition, Veterans Day, Memorial Day, the 4th of July, and President's Day will all be fee-free as well.
And what are you hearing from park advocates and lawmakers about the impact that this will have?
So not only are they pushing back against removing MLK Day and Juneteenth in particular, calling the move racist because both of those days honor Black history, MLK Day in particular is typically a volunteer day of action at our local parks here in California. So they're concerned that all of the work that happens early on in the year during that day will not.
Yes. In fact, we spoke with Kristen Brengel with the National Parks Conservancy Association. She worries fewer people will volunteer now that it won't be free anymore.
What a great message it sends to park visitors to come and do community service in parks and not have to pay an entrance fee. So this has been a long-standing fee-free day because it's also a day of service. So this doesn't make any sense to us why they removed it. And we're also concerned about taking Juneteenth off the fee-free days because it recognizes an important day in African-American history in our country. And this seems to be symptomatic of other things the administration is doing to sort of sanitize Black history in our country.
How will international visitors be affected by these new policies?
So another huge change in the works for next year is a $100 per person fee will be imposed for international travelers entering parks. And that fee is per person. So when you get to the gate and you're entering, usually there's around a $35 vehicle fee. Now anybody in the car who can't prove that they're a U.S. resident will have to pay an additional $100. There will also be ID checks to confirm this at national park entrances. And the annual pass, that's typically $80 for residents. There will be an option for non-residents that's $250 now.
Wow, that is expensive. Do these new policies go into effect January 1st?
Yes. So if you buy a pass after January 1st or try to enter a park after January 1st, you'll be facing these new structures, these new fee-free days. That said, anybody who did already purchase their annual America the Beautiful pass, they kind of operate on a rolling basis. Those passes will still be honored under the old rules.
Okay. And what kind of impact will these changes have on parks and the staff?
So I spoke to some business owners of tourism agencies around Yosemite National Park here in California, and they're particularly worried about this fee on international travel. They're worried it could deter travelers. And these folks who operate tours around the park are also just worried about what this is going to do to the role of the park ranger who collects fees at park entrances, who will now be asked to sort of determine U.S. residency on the fly, checking IDs not just to confirm they are who they say they are, but also for their residency status.
That was KQED's outdoor engagement reporter, Sarah Wright. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Madi.
And that's the California Report for Tuesday, December 9th. We're a production of KQED News. I'm Madi Bolaños. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Forum starts in a minute at 8:59. It's Clark Reed with a look at Bay Area traffic in the East Bay.
In Oakland, an accident northbound 880 before Hagenberger. It's in the left lane. Things are jammed up there from 238. Castro Valley, still have an accident eastbound 580 before Redwood. In the number 2 lane, a crawl there from 238. Novato, still have that accident. A tow truck finally there. South 101 after 37. It's jammed from Roland. Continues that way down to the Marin Civic Center. Clark Reed for KQED.
Thank you, Clark. Traffic support from Murphy McKenna Construction Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from John Muir Health, delivering cardiac surgery with a patient-first approach and minimally invasive techniques in the East Bay at John Muir Health. You're on KQED 88.5 San Francisco, KQEI 89.3 North Highlands, Sacramento, and we're also